Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk. And yes, we play with needles.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do.
It's our third midweek show. And already we're breaking the format. Because we can.
Right, because this started out as a weekly show, and then it rapidly became not that, and then, yeah. I have to say, Gary, I'm very proud of you because you're breaking rules, and I know that that's not a thing you do.
It does make me nervous.
Yes. I know, but I appreciate the effort that you're putting into. Thank you. This is good.
Therapy will work. I know it will. So anyway, we're breaking format because we have a guest, and midweek shows are not supposed to have guests. But Nicola Parkman back with us. Nicola, thank you.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Christine.
So this all came about because Nicola and I have been having exchanges because I'm intensely curious about the whole buying antique samplers at auction, online, and all that goes into it. And so we were having a couple of exchanges, and Nicola was explaining how this all happens, and I had one of those moments where, why are you and I sharing this? Let's tell everybody how this works. So Nicola's with us this week. So thanks again.
You're very welcome.
Yep. So we'll later on in the show, we get to learn about buying antique samplers online. And then Hands Across the Sea and Nicola and Sigrid have yet another sampler introduction. So we're going to talk about that.
And you mustn't forget about Torsten.
Oh, Torsten. Oh,
yes,
Torsten.
Yes, because it's Sigrid and Torsten.
my deepest apologies to Torsten. We have to get him on the show. We got to talk to Torsten.
Of course.
Yes. So we're going to talk about the Old Scott, which is the newest introduction from Hands Across the Sea. And Nicola has been kind enough to give us three copies of the Old Scott chart that we can give away, so we'll be doing that in each of the next 3 weeks, and so we really appreciate that. That's going to be fun. So here we go. I got a list of stuff. Some of this just personal stuff I have to tell about, so you guys may or may not have any interest in saying anything. But Orna Willis, who people will remember was our third or fourth show, something like that. What just really like her designs and her use of color. She has a new thing she's starting that she calls My Design Process, the How and Why. And you sign up for this thing. I think it's $200. And you basically go along for the ride with Orna as she designs a new chart. And she says she has no idea where she's going. It's just, we're along for the ride with her. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to sign up and go along for the ride with Orna and see how this whole process of creating a design, especially one of hers, happens. But I think it's a great idea for an online class. And she sends you, you sign up and she sends you, I think she just sends you a blank, yeah, she starts with nothing and a bunch of threads that she's decided she's going to use. And then if you signed up, you get to go along for the ride. So we'll have a link so everybody else can sign up. I'm sure she'll take whoever wants to, but it sounds like a good time to me, and to get into the head of somebody as talented as Orna would be, it just seems like it'd be a lot of fun. So I'm signing up.
Her use of color is just out of this world. You know, you turn up a site on Facebook and on the internet, and it just sort of vibrates off the screen. I'm really impressed with it.
Yeah, she really has a different eye for color. It's fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can see that as soon as you go onto her website or her blog. You know, it's just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a wonderful experience signing up and seeing how, you know, she does design things. You know, she's obviously got this fantastic eye for color and shapes and textures. I think I'll be signing up with you, Gary.
Okay.
I think we might all be.
Yeah.
The thing about these kinds of things, though, is it makes me nervous because I feel that pressure to keep up. And so maybe a few late nights with the needle, but we'll get it done. Which late nights with a needle for you, Nicola? That's nothing. Do you ever sleep?
Rarely.
Okay. All right. And then, and I'm blaming you for this one, Nicola. Absolutely blaming you for this one. Because you and your samplers have gotten me out of my cross-stitch rut. Where after that stocking, I said no more cross-stitch for a long time. But it's your fault, Nicola. So, because I've ordered the Millennium frame from, what's that company again?
It's from Needle Needs.
Needle Needs over there in England. And so I'm waiting for that to come. And that supposedly, well, that's what you use, right? That's supposedly just the best scroll frame you can get your hands on.
It's the best one that I've found. And, you know, I couldn't stitch without my Millennium frame now. I'm a two-handed stitcher, so I need to have a frame. And it just offers me such drum-tight tension. And I think it's a product that will outlive me. It's an heirloom item. They're so well made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what you told me. You told me heirloom item, and I said to my wife, this is an heirloom item, and she looked at me like, please.
wait until you receive it. I'm sure you'll be very pleased.
Yeah, I'm anxious to receive it. And I got a little, I'm getting off the track here, but got a little lesson in American patience because I ordered the thing because it said it was on their site available for ordering or something like that. And that, in my little mind, meant I could order it and it would be coming in a few days. But this is a craftsman that makes these things by hand, by himself, and available for order means that you can put an order in and you'll get on the list. And so we're looking at, what'd you say, 8 to 10 weeks, something like that?
I think it's 10 to 12 weeks they specify on their website.
Okay.
But I think on average they try and get them out for about 10 weeks.
Yeah, so it's one of those...
I say they, it's only him.
Yeah. Well, there's probably a backlog, too. You know, there may be a list of orders that need to be gotten to.
Mm-hmm. I actually called in to Needle Needs last year. You know, I became a customer about 5 years ago, but last year I was going past and I thought I would call in. And I was absolutely amazed at this little workshop and this man working away making these frames and stands, and you know, it was just an amazing process to watch. And when you talk to him, you can see his love and his pride in his workmanship, and you know, the wood they use and the drying process for that wood, you know, there's a lot of care and thought that goes into them. And I was actually desperate for a pair of 36-inch bars, and I was hoping I might have been able to have got some while I was there. And I said, well, I can see some 36-inch bars over there. And he said, oh, the wood's not quite straight. And I looked at them and I said, it is straight. He said, no. He said, look at this. And it was, the wood had just moved a little bit, and he would not sell me those bars.
Oh my, wow.
So, you know, when you get them, you'll see the quality.
Yeah, well,
and of course he just can't keep up with demand.
Yeah, and of course every time it gets mentioned, I'm sure, is, like Christine said, another batch of orders head in. But
right.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, because you have the frame, and then you have the stand too, right?
I do. Yes.
Are you working with a floor stand or a table stand?
I have a table stand, but in the house I always work with the floor stand. You know, I have my little stitching nest, and I have my armchair, and I have my light, and I have my table with lots of little drawers in that I have all my bits and bobs. And I'm set up there with my stand. And, you know, I'm just a two-handed stitcher. I like to use both my left and my right. And you just have to have a stand to do that. But I also have a lap stand, which, you know, in the summer I've got a lovely veranda and I like to go and sit out on the veranda. Well, I would take my lap stand there. Or if I go to a class, a lap stand is sort of easier to transport. Although the floor stands, they are very light. You know, you can pick them up with one hand. But, you know, a lap stand is far more practical for when you're on the move.
Yeah, just watching the videos that you've made with those things, you can just tell that the quality of their product is beyond yes. compare. Yeah.
Yeah. Those videos came about in such a funny way. A friend, a long-distance friend from America was asking me some questions, and it got a little bit complicated messaging back and forth. And I was in the middle of doing my housework, and I thought, oh, I'll do a quick little video and I'll send it to her. And then that ended up going on YouTube because it was too long to send via Messenger. And it started off as a private video, and then it sort of went public for other friends to see. And then, of course, it went viral. And there's me with no makeup on talking about this frame. But it's a funny thing, you know, from that first video, I'm now doing tutorial videos and doing presentations of samplers via video. So, you know, little things grow.
Oh, so that, yes, that really definitely. Kicked you off then, huh, with videos?
Yes, it did.
She got over the camera fright.
Well, no. When I do a video, I have a picture of a friend in my mind, and I'm talking to a friend. I'm not talking to the world.
Okay.
Otherwise, I would, all my words would come out back to front and jumbled up if I did that.
Yep. Well, I'm a big fan of the one where your dog keeps interfering. That's my favorite.
He's actually in most of my videos, but usually he's had a good walk and he's happy to lie down and go to sleep. Sometimes I have to speak a little bit louder to cover up his snores.
Well, he's a great looking dog, I'll say that. Yeah.
He is, yes.
All right, so
and he understands so I can say he understands when Mummy's stitching that he can't interrupt her, so he's very good about that.
Oh. Well trained then.
Yes, we've had that sorted out from a puppy.
All right, so back to why it's your fault. So, I've ordered the Millennium Stand. I have, as we talked about, I have the chart. I have the chart of the sampler that has my daughter's name on it. And then we have the Sarah Borton chart coming. That's ordered. So, okay, you've done damage there. And then I was caught without a project. Well, I have projects, but not one that was really handy and easily put together for when I travel. And so then I was in the Welcome Stitchery the other day, and I'll tell the story about that in a minute. And they had in there the new Hands-On Design 12 Days of Christmas ornament designs. And I really liked, I'd seen them before, and really like them because they're kind of a arched square shaped, I guess it is. But instead of always trying to do, you know, two turtle doves kind of thing, the dominant element is the word. So like for the first day of Christmas, it's partridge. Second day, it's doves, hens, whatever.
Oh, cool.
And they're beautifully done. And I'd thought about getting them and doing them because I'm trying to do some ornaments just in the fill-in, and when I travel it's easier to do those. And then when I got to Welcome Stitchery and they had them there, and I they had the cloth, and it looks like just a red cloth in the pictures, but it's actually a red gingham linen. And when you see the cloth, it's really beautiful. And so that tipped it in for me because it was different than your standard solid colored linen. It's a gingham pattern in there that does not show up well on the photos. So I bought two pieces of linen and the necessary threads, and then the chart, of course. And then there's a little add-on thing that's like a teardrop that has the number on it for each of the days. So you get that as an extra thing, and then there are instructions for finishing it. I don't know. I'll probably send them to Vonna Pfeiffer and have her finish them so they actually look like something. But Nicola, basically you've the needle point's been sitting on the side here, and it's all your fault because it's all cross stitch.
You have been enabled.
Yes.
Yeah. Mind you, these ornaments, they're absolutely gorgeous. Those little teardrops and the little hooks really caught my eye. They're going to look beautiful on a little tree at Christmas. Well worth doing, Gary.
I think so. Yep. Well, I have a lot of travel coming up, so I'll be able to knock them out. And then I was on a trip this week and took it all with me and forgot my light. And stitching on red 40 count linen with a hotel lamp. It's just Yeah, I just put it aside. It wasn't worth it. So
what light do you use when you travel?
I have a what do they call it? A hammerhead or something. It's a clip-on LED light.
Mm-hmm.
Just takes three AAA batteries, but a clip-on thing.
Yeah.
And so I just find some way to clip it on, or I'll actually clip it onto the hoop or the frame, and it has a kind of a gooseneck thing, and that's has two settings, and so that gives me more than enough light in those situations, so I can work away at it. Yeah.
I have one of those as well, and I think that LED light, it's just, you know, I sometimes think that my light is more important than my glasses. You know, you can see so much more with light.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I totally agree, because sometimes I find myself putting my glasses aside because I can see better. Things are larger without my glasses, if that makes any sense. But as long as there's a good light, and I think it's just, it's one of those age things, because I'll be working and say, there's not enough light, I can't do anything. And my son will sit here and I'll yell at him to turn on the light. You can't possibly be reading. He's like, it's fine. And then I realized that I am now at that age where I remember my grandparents yelling at me to turn on the light. And now I am them.
There you go.
Yeah.
We mock those we are to whom we are to become. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think the LED lights have become so much sort of whiter, the light. When they first came out, they were sort of tinged with a little bit of yellow. But now, you know, the daylight quality of them is so good.
It's really crisp,
Very much so.
You have good when we do makeup, actually, at work, that's one of the things that we fight with is, finding good daylight, because under any other light, things don't look at all the same color. And when you're trying to match two colors that are almost identical and try to tell the difference, it's impossible. But LED works out for us, or just north natural light. But it's really key to be able to distinguish. You know, sometimes I'm finding too, when you're working with sort of a colorway of thread, and they're just all of the, you know, from light to dark of the same sort of thread, that you can, it's tough to tell which one you're working with sometimes. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
having
I totally
that
agree.
Light. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Makes a huge difference.
Yep. Now, Nicola, my main light for stitching is, I don't know how many magnification magnifiers surrounded by LEDs all the way around. And that is just perfect, because you can just see so easily. What do you use? What's your light?
It's a daylight lamp, and it's got the magnifier. I don't use the magnifier to stitch with, but when I'm reproducing, I do use the magnifier, and I've actually got the extra strength one on there. You just need that sort of higher magnification. I've got two. I've got one in the study and one in my sewing room, because a little bit heavy to sort of move between the two rooms. That's my excuse that I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. It sounds rational and well thought out. Go with it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But the daylight lamps, you know, they're very good. They're something that we can access in England, because, you know, we don't have such good supplies as you know, you have in the States. And the one I have is the Ultra Slim XR daylight lamp with LED, and I've got the floor, it's got the base for it, so it turns it into a floor stand as opposed to a desk stand, and it has this really lovely long arm, so that I can really sort of get it in the right position, so I'm not I haven't got my head bent in an odd position to take advantage of the magnification. So I think it's not only the light and the magnification. It's the arm and the reach and the flexibility of that arm that's important when you decide on a light.
Yeah, that whole ergonomics thing, you really got to watch that. Just in general, you hear many women complaining their shoulder or their elbow or their wrist or whatever is hurting. And yeah, that ergonomics, sitting upright in a good chair and good light and at a good height is so critical, because these people who sit and stitch for 4 or 5 hours, I wish I had that kind of time, number one, but just to do that, you really got to watch your positioning or you'll do some long-term damage, you know?
And I think as well that when you're sewing for long periods of time, it's very important to flex your legs. The same as if you're on an aeroplane, you know, and your legs are in one position, it's important to have little breaks. And I think as well with your eyes, that if you're focusing on close-up work for long periods, that's not doing the muscles in your eyes any good. You know, you should get into the habit of looking up and looking into the distance, just to stretch your eye muscles as well.
Yeah, I've known people that not stitching people, but in general, set an alarm on their phone or whatever every 15 minutes or so to remind themselves to exactly look up, or even to get up and walk around the room once just to change the position. Yeah, it's pretty important.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. And when I'm stitching for long periods of time, I do flex my legs. I do stretch my eyes, and I also wipe my hands, because I think that, you know, I keep a pack of wet wipes, baby wet wipes, you know, that aren't perfumed or anything, and I just routinely just wipe my hands just to freshen them up, to keep my work and my threads really pristine. And that's a little routine I have when I'm stitching.
I think that's one of my favorite stories about the Royal Institute of Needlework. I think I just botched the name of it. But anyway, the place in England that stitches all of the wedding gowns for the royal family. And I remember reading a story where they were describing how they go about making the lace and all of these things. And there's a rule that whoever's working on that lace has to wear white cotton gloves, and the gloves have to be changed every half an hour. And it's a hard and fast rule, and for that exact reason, because your hands get, you know, sweaty and pick up things, and this way the lace remains completely pristine. I just always thought that was a neat kind of fact.
Yeah, it is. Can you imagine stitching wearing gloves?
No.
But then I suppose if that's how you learn, that's what you adapt to.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you do that, Nicola, because it's exactly what I do. As you're stitching along, you can feel your hands getting a little oily, sweaty. And so then I'll stop and go wash them. And because, I get pretty obsessed about not having, when I'm all done with a large project in particular, not looking back and seeing that the thread color has been dulled in some way. And
Yeah, when I, you know, judge a needlework competition and you get a chance to have a look at other people's work in close-up detail, you know, you can often see some grime on a piece, and I just think it's such a shame. They could be stitching with a white thread, and all of a sudden you can see where the thread has got grimy, and it's such a shame to put so many hours into a piece and then just be let down on that little bit of detail.
Yeah, it really is. So it's interesting that judged pieces, that would be a factor, but because you would think that people who are having things judged would take that extra step. I don't know. Do you cover the work that you've done? How do you approach that? I want to see if we match up here. How do you approach the work that you've done? Do you stitch top to bottom so that the work you've done is always up and out of the way? Do you cover it? How do you go about it?
Well, with the Millennium Frame, you have three sides of side stretchers. I tend to work on the smallest one, so you don't have a very big area on show. My work isn't exposed. And it's very difficult. I tend to start top left-hand corner, and I like to work a border all the way around, and then I tend to work up. so I can't really say that I sort of work to cover an area up, but I am very, very careful about my work. If I get up just to go and put the kettle on, I throw a piece of cloth over my work. I never leave my work unattended. If I took a telephone call when I was stitching and I don't even get up out of my chair, I would automatically throw a cloth over it, and it's a habit I've got into.
See, Christine, I'm normal. See, I'm normal, yeah. Christine. See?
No.
I do exactly that.
I'm quiet because I'm listening to these things, because that's one of the things that I've been wondering as I've been working on a piece, is I'll put it down and then have anxiety until I pick it up again that somebody's going to bump into it, spill something on it, a cat will walk by. I've felt very uncomfortable with this, but now... Good, I'm glad. So now I can cover it.
I learnt the hard way. My very first piece on linen was Dutch Beauty, which is a huge piece. And I was about three quarters of the way through. And it was in the days when I used a hoop. And I fell asleep. And when I woke up, I picked my piece of work up off my lap. And I put it on my side table. And there was a mug of tea. And I was absolutely heartbroken because Dutch Beauty is such a huge piece, and I washed it and washed it or rinsed it, and I couldn't get all this tea out, so I knew it the hard way. So this is why I'm very, very careful, and it's one of the reasons why I switch from a hoop to a frame.
So can I ask then, so while you're working on a piece, let's say you've completed an area, is there benefit, and how would you go about covering that area so that it would remain clean? Would that be something that would be advisable? Or would you just try to keep your hands and your work area clean?
I keep my hands very clean. I don't tend to rest my hands on the fabric. It's just how I've learnt to stitch. Mm-hmm. So my work is pristine at all times. You know, I'm very, very fussy. Every stitch is analyzed and checked, and if the stitch isn't sitting right, I will change it. That's just the way I am. Mm-hmm. So it's not really an issue for me. And as I'm working on a roller frame, it just gets rolled away, my work. And the other thing I do, if I stop, I always slacken off the tension on my work. And at the end of the stitching session, I will just sort of unwind quite a bit of my work so it's not pressurized on the roller, and then I pleat it, and then I pop it into a very large pillowcase, and then it's protected until I pick it up and start to stitch on it the next day.
I was thinking the pillowcase idea. That was actually one of the first things that came to mind.
I also do all those things too, that's great. I would
be nervous about putting it in, because the first logical thing would be a plastic bag, but I would feel very nervous about that just because it doesn't breathe. Do you know what I mean? So that, you know, any humidity would be in, and I guess if you're stitching often enough, it's not an issue, but still the idea of putting it in plastic doesn't feel right to me because I would be afraid it would, you know.
Yes. Something. I always use a nice quality, you know, cotton pillowcase, and I feel the same way. Cotton is natural. It's a natural fiber.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I understand that, Christine, and agree.
I like my threads. Once I open up a skein, I'll put them in those floss away plastic bags. Mm-hmm. And I tend to store them in there, but I never seal them up. No. So that air can move in or out.
I use the floss away bags. The floss away bags are a wonderful invention. I use those as well. But I'm just not fussed about putting my actual project in a plastic bag for storage. Maybe there's nothing wrong with that. It's just what I'm used to.
Right. If it doesn't feel right, then that's reason enough not to do it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But those floss away bags are just wonderful. You know, I store mine on great big metal hoops, and I just pull them off for the project and put them onto a smaller hoop, and I keep them all in numerical order. So,
Those are my go-to. Other than DMC floss, that's, yeah, everything's in those bags, or just laying in my storage drawer. But if once I've opened a skein, yeah, that's where it goes. Yep. So
such a simple idea, but just so wonderful.
Right. Okay, so I have to tell the story of taking my friend Mike to Welcome Stitchery. Mm-hmm. So my friend Mike, he's an editor. So his wife, Donna, and her sister, Sylvia, are stitchers, cross stitchers primarily from what I know. And they listen to us all the time. And, so Mother's Day was coming up and Mike wanted to get his wife, Donna, some stitching things for Mother's Day. So would I help him? Well, of course, you know, why not? An excuse to go to the store, you know.
Tragic.
Darn right.
That's quite a hardship.
It was a real struggle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we met for breakfast and then we headed to Welcome Stitchery and, a Saturday morning. And boy, Donna had a good Mother's Day. I'm here to tell you. She had a good Mother's Day. So, took Mike in and of course all the ladies were in there working. And they fixed Mike up. We helped him. She had given him some chart ideas, and they had most of those. And then there was one other series that she had said if they have those and there are any new ones to get those. And then he got one was a Mill Hill kit, and then there was another chart. I don't remember them all because I don't do that much cross stitching that I know all the designers. But he bought all the threads and the linen cloth for that. And then at Welcome Stitchery, they have, other than this, they have the Sudbury boxes, you know, the little boxes that you can put inserts in. But they also have, and I've not seen these anywhere else, somebody, I think in the east somewhere, I want to say Pennsylvania, but that's probably so far off that I shouldn't even say it, a guy who makes these handmade wooden boxes that are held together with dowels and I assume, tongue and groove stuff. Beautiful, beautiful boxes. And I just love them. I've done a couple things with them. So one of the kits was about the same size as a little 5x5 jewelry box. So she just had to stitch a few more rows to make it fit. So one of her, kits designs also came with a box to put it in. And so I thought that was a real neat package. So, but
well done.
Yeah. So we were in there better part of 2 hours. My instructions from Margo were whatever you do, don't spend as much as Mike spends. So I was hoping he would spend quite a bit so I could spend some. Cause if he was in there and spent $20, it was like, oh, come on, Mike. so we had a great time in there talking to the ladies. And when we left, he says, boy, I can see why people enjoy this hobby and enjoy going to a store like that where there's all the, you know, all the charts and patterns and threads and, you know, incredibly talented, people in there to help you out. And, yeah, he gained a good appreciation for the hobby. I don't think he's the stitching type, but I think he really gained an appreciation. And of course, it was weird it's always weird when I go into a shop anyway. But then when two males walk into a shop, you know, the heads all rise and and you know it's a weird thing. It's one of the strangest feelings I've ever felt out on the road, and I'll go into a shop in the evening by myself, and I get that look like, okay, are you here to rob me, or you know, you immediately, you get that look, and no, actually, I'm here because I want to be here, but and I'm always curious if other men have get that same reaction of uncomfortable, especially if it's the proprietor just by herself. You know, just weird. So,
well, we've talked about that. That's like any time I have to go to Home Depot and I'm in the plumbing or construction areas, particularly if I'm wearing a dress, because the first reaction is, sweetheart, what do you need here? Because you can't possibly be in the right section. Would you like me to show you the closet organizers? And then after a while, they just start ignoring me and looking at me as if I am strange when I ask them for things and know what I'm asking for. because, you know, as our old hobby, one of the things that we learned to do very well is plumbing. So, yeah, I will go to the plumbing section for things for that or, you know, to repair something in my house. And for some reason, women are not supposed to know how to do that.
Yes.
Especially women in dresses.
Yes.
So...
And I would kill to follow you in from a distance to a Home Depot while you instruct them in what you want. And...
Well, so, right. And it's funny because I went one time, I was building a tank for a friend who is a guy and who is, I think, 6'5" and just this behemoth of a man. So, and he had no experience with it whatsoever. So I went in and I knew exactly what I needed to get. And I needed, you know, these, you know, bunch of pieces and et cetera. And I was looking for a particular thing that they didn't have. So, and it was the strangest thing because we found a service person and I said, hi, you know, I'm doing a project. I'm looking for, you know, this valve. And he would only answer my friend. Yeah. And then he would ask my friend a question like, oh, well, do you need it to be this material or that material? And he would say, I have no idea. Ask her. So, but this went on for like 15 minutes. You know, he just wasn't getting that I was the customer, right? It's very, but yeah. So get used to it, Gary, is what I'm trying to say, is that it will become entertainment for you to see which people will make assumptions about you and which people don't care.
Yes.
You know, you will find that going forward.
It's a weird feeling, though. Yeah.
I think it's wonderful that you actually have a needlework store to go into. I don't have one of those.
Oh, you don't have. I was going to ask you about how readily available stores are to you.
They're just not.
Okay.
They're just not. We have a little sort of fabric shop, but it's sort of fabric, you know, to make a cushion or a pair of curtains or a dress, and they have like a haberdashery section. And you might get some Ada and you might get some dimensional anchor kits. But, you know, you certainly wouldn't get linen and you certainly wouldn't get sampler charts. I don't know anywhere in Cornwall that carries a range of linen for, you know, for cross stitches and only stores that have very small amounts of charts. So, yeah, you're very lucky that you have stores to go in.
Oh, trust me, I appreciate it. Really, I do. And I do everything I can to support the store because it's just so important to have those kinds of stores.
Yeah. When I went to Nashville, I was very restricted in my time to get out of my room to go and visit other rooms. But I did manage to buy an awful lot of scissors. and I was just sort of thinking, what if they stopped me and asked me, why have you got all these scissors when I was going through, you know, customs?
Security. Sure, sure.
Yeah. They must have thought I had a scissor fetish, which I do have.
Well, you know, everybody's got their own particular tool that has to be, you know, just a certain way.
Yeah.
I can appreciate this completely. This doesn't sound strange to me at all.
So Nicholas, so virtually everything you use, you have to order then online.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the internet just makes stitching possible. You know, the internet links you with other stitchers around the world. It gives you access to the products that you need to stitch. So, you know, it's just absolutely wonderful. You know, until I actually discovered blogs on the internet, I didn't even realize that people stitched on linen because all the kits I had ever seen were Ada kits. You know, and you are just so lucky in the States, the amount of stores that you do have. Like, I know that not everybody has access to a store, but, you know, you do have stores that you can travel to.
Right.
And that's just absolutely wonderful. Like, we do have stores in the UK, but nothing around where I live.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad. You should start one. No, don't.
No, I am actually officially retired.
Okay. Yeah, don't do that.
You know what? Speaking of stores, I think we need to address something that came up during this week.
Yes.
In response to something that I had said on a podcast. And I think I was misinterpreted. And that's because I speak, you know, I've known Gary for forever, for many, many years. And so we both know each other's history. But of course, none of you do. No one knows these things. So, you know, I'll say things and not realize that people don't understand the context in which I'm saying them. So the gist of what happened was, a listener had written in and was quite upset that I had said, I was talking about the stores like Michael's and AC Moore around here, which are our general craft stores, like you were just talking about, Nicola, that have just a little bit of this and that, and so nothing for somebody that's, you know, very involved in the hobby, but, you know, might have a few kids or things like that. And what I was talking about was yarn, particularly, and how the yarn that you can get online or at a specialty store is so much higher quality, or there's more variety because you can get hand dyed things and things like that. And what the person interpreted that to mean was that I was knocking, Michael's and places like that because the gist of it was that, you know, for some of us, that's all that we can afford. So we work with these acrylics and stuff and we're happy with them. And it's sort of snobbish to say that, you know, you shouldn't work with those things. And that wasn't my intention at all. So historically, I'm a single parent. So any hobby that I've ever done has had to be funded by a part-time job that I would take on the side. So I am certainly not the lady of leisure or lady of means that was assumed by any means. And for me to have the privilege of working with some of these, you know, really, really fine fibers takes a bit of work for me. And it's I look at it as a privilege. It's not something that I can do easily. And I don't have a giant stash. What I buy, I use. So, you know, what I was trying to say was not so much that Michael's is bad or that working with acrylics is bad, because that's pretty much what I've done most of my life. What I was trying to say was that if you have the opportunity to work with a fiber that's been, you know, handcrafted, the difference is remarkable. And it's really it becomes an entirely different experience. And I liken it to, you know, Gary's a photographer. And when he was teaching me photography many years ago, I, you know, had a very inexpensive camera because, again, I'm not, you know, tremendously wealthy or anything like that. And I would take pictures and they would come out okay. And then I would, you know, borrow someone else's camera that had, you know, very good glass lenses and, you know, the right kind of camera. And I would take exactly the same picture and it would be astronomically better. And I realized that it was just the privilege of having the right expensive equipment to use. So by all means, am I not knocking Michael's or, working with acrylic yarns, because quite a bit of them are pretty nice. I was just commenting on how wonderful an experience it was for me to see what else is available. And then now all of those things are on my list of things to covet. So that will probably be the rate limiting step is my stitching and, you know, ability to afford things. Because truly, none of the hobbies that we do, Gary, are inexpensive.
Right.
And each of the things that you do requires a significant investment of money. But I forget who it was talking. It might have been Tess and Thorne when they said, well, okay, you can look at it as, you know, you're spending $100 or more on a painted canvas or a stitch painted canvas. But if you imagine the number of hours you spend with that canvas and compare it to how much you would spend on going to a movie or out to dinner, it all kind of works out to be the same. It's just a matter of how you allocate your resources. So my apologies for knocking Michael's. That wasn't my intention. I was less knocking something and more appreciating all the beautiful things we have available now.
Yeah, I think that it can also apply to Ada and linen. There is there's absolutely nothing wrong working in Ada. And again, when you come to linen, I think a piece is just as beautiful on 28 count linen as it is on 40 count linen. We all work to what appeals to us and what we can work on. I have many pieces hanging in my home very proudly that were stitched on Ada, and they take pride of place alongside my pieces that I have stitched on linen. They're all part of my needlework journey. Mm-hmm. Now, I prefer to stitch on linen, and I prefer to stitch on 40 count linen, but I know that one day, as my eyesight deteriorates, I might go back down to stitching on 36 or 32 count linen. There mustn't be snobbery over whether we stitch on Ada or linen.
No. And that's the other thing is that, as people get to know both Gary and I, they will hopefully realize that snobbery is not something that I think I'm capable of. So, despite living in New York, this is people make these assumptions about people that live in New York that we're all, these very elite, educated, people. And no, we're just regular folk, like everybody else. Yeah. It's a funny thing.
Yeah. Talking of needlework stores and local needlework stores, whilst I don't have a local one, later this year, I'm going to be taking a 12-hour road trip to go to a needlework store in Cumbria. And that's Phobles. And I'm so looking forward to be able to walk into a needlework store and be able to hammer my credit card a little bit.
Yes.
12 hours to get to a needlework store? Wow.
Well, to this needlework store, and it's a very beautiful needlework store, and it actually happens to carry our charts as well. So, I'm looking forward to going there.
Yeah, so, I have to throw in my story, because I've mentioned many times I'm a big proponent of supporting the local needlework store. Because they're just so important. And, that experience I had with Mike here this past week where he had a list of things and we walked in there and they had just about all of them. There was one, they were just sold out, and it's so important. And I, the story that sticks in my mind, and this happened, probably 3 years ago, but I was in Welcome Stitchery on a Saturday and there were a lot of people in there, and there was this woman who chewed up a good deal of time, one of the employees, selecting charts and, finding this and finding that. And she got what she wanted. And I'd been there a while because I was just talking and hanging out. And then she proudly announced, so that many people could hear, that, okay, said to her friend, all right, now we're off to Michael's to get thread. And, I just about bit my tongue off because I really wanted to tell her what I thought. But I didn't, because it wasn't my place. But it was one of those things. Well, you got experts here, and you have everything you could want for stitching, and then now you announce that you're going to go somewhere else and spend your money on thread to save, 15 cents or whatever it is a skein. I have no idea. I just thought that was, that was thoughtless, number one. But as the store owner who was in hearing distance, she has to stand there and say nothing. And that was one of those, I really felt bad and I really wanted to say, lady, really? You're going to go save, a few cents elsewhere after you just used all this expertise that you can't get at Michael's. And, you can get the same thread there. Yes, I agree. But, there's a little more that you can get from the local needlework store when you're doing that and you walk out with a fistful of charts. And, it's always bothered me. That one just sticks in my craw that, stop and think. It's, support these stores because it's hard for them to stay in business. And Monica's just celebrated her 29th year, in business. And that's a huge accomplishment. And, it's just hard, and I've got a bunch of stuff on order And I asked her about that the other day, and I got that look like, oh, I know they're not here yet. And I can just imagine how she is constantly having to order specialty threads and charts and all kinds of things for people in addition to the inventory she carries. And, you know, it's a tough thing, yet you can tell she just loves it. I mean, she loves working mm-hmm. with customers and helping them out and seeing the successes and all those things. And mm. you know, it takes an extra something to keep stores like that going. And so mm. that's why I mention often about supporting those stores. They're just so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And you so often hear of stores closing, and it's been really nice this year to hear of the store that's opening in Asheville in North Carolina. Sassy Jack's is opening, and I just think that's so wonderful. And in fact, I'm going to visit Sassy Jack's next year, and I'm going to visit the attic, and I have warned my husband, don't look at the credit card statement when I come home.
Yes, you're going to do damage.
I am. I'm going to spoil myself.
Okay. Hey, we're running out of time. We got to talk about reproduction samplers here. Holy smokes. Yeah, we got to get going here. Okay, so, all right. So the first thing, oh, man, I wasn't paying attention.
I don't think we're going to get it all in, Gary.
Oh, I think we will. I think we will, Nicola. Hang in there.
Okay.
Another shot of caffeine. Hang in there. You'll be all right.
Okay. I'll talk fast.
So, okay, so what, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we talked to you, maybe more, and you just introduced Sarah Borton, or Borden?
Yes.
Borden. Borton, yes. And Borton. Now you're here along with another one called the Old Scott, a sampler that Thorsten and Sigrid.
Sigrid.
And notice I mentioned Thorsten first.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Now, I have found out about Thorsten and whether he stitches or not.
Oh, good.
And Thorsten has stitched. He can stitch, but he much prefers woodwork. His hobby is wood turning. So that's what he likes to do. But he does enjoy reproducing the samplers. He enjoys studying them. And, you know, transferring the stitches to the computer program. So I did find that out for you, Gary.
Well, thanks for that. Oh, and wood turning. Oh, I'm envious of that. People who are good at that, and I'm sure he is. Oh, boy.
Yes. I think he actually made Sigrid a loom for her weaving.
Oh.
So
he is skilled. Yes.
Yes, it sounds like it, doesn't it?
And is able to stitch. Yeah. Okay.
He is able to stitch.
He can make an X. All right, Thorsten, good.
All right. Yeah. So tell us about this new one.
Well, the Old Scott is a very exciting sampler. Sandra and I, we really love history, and both of us really love Jacobite history. And Sandra's had a theory for some time about a particular motif that you see on some Scottish samplers, and I saw a sampler come up for auction with this motif on. So we bought it last year, and it was just a lovely sampler for Sigrid to reproduce. I knew that Sigrid would love the sampler because of the needlework. So it's been very, very exciting, and as Sigrid's been reproducing it and stitching it, Sandra and I have been following through her theory, you know, it's just been great fun for us. We believe that the motif, which is a very grand building with five stories, many, many windows, an unusual roof, and some uprights that are very distinctive on the route, is Linlithgow Palace, which is just outside Edinburgh. And Linlithgow was the royal residence of the Stuart kings and queens, and Mary Queen of Scots was born there. Anyway, trying to locate this building, we've been studying all the grand houses in Scotland. And of course, one of the last ones you get to is the one that you want.
Of course.
And then the funny thing was that on the weekend, I was just finalising the video presentation that we had done. I was going through the credits for the video of where we'd sourced information. And I opened Naomi Tarrant's book. And there, next to this sampler, was Linifka. So all along, that information had been under our nose, that a little girl who'd stitched an almost identical motif had been born in Linifka, which, of course, sort of ties it back to this building that we had discovered. So, again, it's all about our love of history. But Sandra's had a theory that the man that's depicted on the steps of this palace was either Bonnie Prince Charlie or the old pretender, his father. And, of course, we've got nothing concrete to back that up other than it's what we suspect, you know, the person is. So this sampler, it's all really been about the history behind it for us. But it's a very beautiful sampler. The colours in it are absolutely gorgeous. You tend to think of Scottish samplers as being green and red. That's what most people associate with Scotland. But Scotland is such a beautiful place. You've got the yellow in the gorse. You've got the purple in the thistles. You've got the blues in the bluebells. You've got the beautiful pinks and reds in the thrift and in the thistles as well.
Nicola doesn't realize she's just described my tattoo perfectly.
Yes.
Right.
So I have a tattoo of the flowers of the British Islands.
Right.
So it's basically what you just said. It's thistles and bluebells and cottage roses.
Yeah.
There you go. So, yes.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah. So this sampler is sort of packed with the colors of the glens and the moors and the shores of Scotland. It's so beautiful. I'm somebody that's very driven by colour and light, so this really appeals to me. And this little girl, you know, she used colour very, very well, the same as the lady that you had on the show, Melba Kelly. You know, she has this good eye for colour as well. So going back to the sampler, it's been a wonderful, exciting journey with this one. We've been working on it probably for about the last 9 months. So it's a long journey from when you see a sampler and you get it to when you actually make it available for others. And the model has arrived at the Attic Needleworks this evening, and it's now on display at the Attic. So when you go, Gary, you will be able to see this model.
Okay, you promised that, because I was counting on seeing Sarah Borton, and then you went and sold it, so.
But Sarah's gone to a very, very good home. She's gone to a needleworker who I admire her work, and it was just so nice that she's, you know, she's gone to somebody who will appreciate her. I can't keep them all. If I kept them all, they would just be in a in storage, and that's not really what we want for these samplers. We want these samplers to be loved and appreciated. And Sarah will be where she's gone. We didn't expect her to sell so quickly, though.
Yeah, I was not happy. I was not happy to read that in the Attic newsletter. No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Less than 2 weeks from my arrival, But I will get to see the old Scott there, the original.
No, not the original. The original was sold before we finished recording.
There's a pattern here. Nicola, there's a pattern here. Okay, I'm taking this personal now.
I'm sorry. But you will see the model. The model is very, very beautiful.
Okay.
And very true to the original as well.
All right. I need to know which X's Torsten put in. I need to identify those X's only.
Well, he actually, on the chart, he probably put at least 50% of those little X's on the chart.
Okay. All right. Then that's fine. So, and I have to really point out this video you made, because it's a video obviously about the sampler and this building and the figure that's there. But you take us through so much of the history of Scotland and the battles for kingship, whatever it is over there, that I learned a lot watching that video. It's really a great video just to give some history and understanding of what went on in the struggles for power in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Just a terrific story. I actually have watched it twice now. So, yeah, it's very, very good.
But that's all part of our love of samplers. It's the history behind them. And, you know, as I said in the video, a sampler isn't an old, dirty and sometimes tattered pieces of linen to us. These samplers are those girls, and we want to immerse ourselves in the period that these little girls lived in, because then we can connect to them and we can understand them.
Yes.
And it's just, you know, it's just wonderful. You know, the first thing we do when a sampler catches our eye is research the little girl. That's so important to us. And it's all about bringing these samplers to life. And the history is just so fascinating. You learn so much. And, you know, Jacobite history, well, in England or sort of in the UK, you know, we've all grown up with the story of Flora Macdonald and Bonnie Prince Charlie. And, you know, the Sky Boat song, I had to get that into the video because children in this country, we learnt to sing that song in school, and it's such a haunting song. When the tune is in your head, you can't get it out of your head. And I was very fortunate that Jo Burgess, who's a wonderful musician and actress, she allowed me to use her recording of the song on the video.
And wasn't you singing? I was sure that was you singing.
No, that wasn't even me humming. It was me playing the piano.
Oh, okay, okay.
If you caught the piano bit about Come All Ye Faithful, that was me playing.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll take that. All right. Yeah, live performance by Nicola right there. Okay.
That's right, yeah. You would not want to hear me singing. The only person that hears me singing is Bertie Boo when we're walking.
Okay. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I was just saying, by bringing the sampler to life for us, we hope that we're bringing the sampler alive to you as well.
Oh, I think without a doubt.
Yeah.
I learned so much just in that video that I actually got it. The sampler itself initially didn't appeal to me, but after watching the video a second time, that now I start to, exactly, it draws me into the sampler and what's there and what it means. It works. It's great. It really is fun.
Yeah. And I think sometimes with samplers, it's so easy just to glance at them and not appreciate them. But if you stop and you look at a sampler and you study a sampler, I think in every piece of needlework, there is something to admire, something that will attract you. You can appreciate it on some level. It's just a question of stopping and looking.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, and what got you to us this week was here, I don't know how many days ago, you were watching an auction and posting about it on Facebook, and I just happened to check in at the right time. And there was one sampler that sold for $11,000, and it just kept going up and up and up, and it was a beautiful sampler. And so then you and I started having a discussion about this whole auction process, and just fascinating to me what you go through. So tell about how this is that you find samplers, and because you're watching this online, right, when you do these things for the most part?
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about how you do that. Are you constantly searching these auction houses for samplers, and then how do you evaluate them? How do you know you're getting the real deal? How do you know that they're in good enough shape that they're worth investing in? Take us through that process.
Well, auctions years ago, you had to go to auctions. So you only ever sort of went to auctions that were close by you. The internet has changed all of that. And you get they're like agents. There's two, that I use predominantly, and that's the Sale Room, which is based in the UK, and Invaluable, which is sort of the UK and the US. And basically, auctioneers put their catalogue up with these companies, and buyers have one central place they can go and look. So if I log on to the sale room, I would put in the search box needlework, samplers, cross stitch, tapestry, and you see what comes up. And you can register things that you're interested in. So if I register to say I would like to receive notifications when a new sampler comes up, the sale room will email me and give me links to those lots. So I have great fun studying the auctions. You learn an awful lot about samplers and about the history of samplers just by watching the auctions. I think that with auctions, you've always got to remember that an auctioneer likes to get the floor excited, because if the adrenaline level goes up, people are tempted to bid higher and higher. Mm-hmm. So my one word of advice when you're bidding at an auction is, don't get carried away. Stick to what you know. Costly mistakes can be made with impulse buys. The lots are catalogued and the auctioneer will describe the lot. Now, if it's a very vague or a very general description, that's where you have to be a little bit careful, because when you buy at auction, it's buyer beware. If an auctioneer has misdescribed an item, then you have more chance of, you know, trying to get your money refunded. So if it's a very general description, there's very little for you to go back to the auctioneer if it's not what you thought it was. And you have to remember that in this day and age, you get reproduction samplers being passed off as antique samplers. Now, this can be deliberate or accidental. You could have somebody who's died and the contents of their house goes to the auction. That lady may have stitched reproduction samplers. Some of these reproduction samplers these days are so good that if somebody is not an expert, they could think it was an antique and describe it as such.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that you get are prints of samplers. And again, some of these prints are so good that when you're looking at a picture on a computer screen, you might think that that is an antique piece of needlework, not a print of the needlework. Like, I have phoned an auctioneer up before now and said, is that a print? And they've gone, no. And I say, are you sure? No, it's definitely not a print. For the auctioneers to ring me back 24 hours later apologising because it was a print. So what you have to remember is that if it looks too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. So, you know, experience and knowledge is very, very important. There's one particular sampler that you see come up for sale regularly, and anybody who follows the auctions knows that this sampler is a print of a sampler. And I've seen pieces come up that I've got hanging in my house that I've stitched myself. So, you know, it's all about knowledge and experience. Like, with internet auctions, obviously, you can't sort of fly across the Atlantic to go to the viewing day. So you have to rely on the auctioneer's description and photograph. But you can ask an auctioneer to give you a condition report, and you can ask the auctioneer specific questions. You can also ask the auctioneer for close-up photographs. Don't leave it to the last minute, because in the 24 to 48 hours leading up to a sale, auctioneers are very busy. So if you want a condition report and photographs, ask sooner rather than later.
Let me interrupt you here. So the auctioneer will pretty much do whatever you need so that you can be comfortable bidding on a piece then.
Well, then, you know, if you
within
ask
reason.
For close-up... Yes, within reason. If you ask for close-up photographs, I've never had an auctioneer refuse. Like, obviously, if you rang up last minute, they're going to be too busy to do that. And the other thing that you need to do is, you might have seen that item for sale a fortnight before the auction. Things could have changed in that fortnight. You need to check the description just before the auction to make sure it hasn't changed.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Like an auctioneer could have had an item, a sampler advertised as an antique sampler. I could have rung him up and said, that's not an antique, that's a reproduction. And he might have changed his description to its reproduction sampler. If you haven't bothered to check the updated description, you know, you could be buying a pig in a poke.
Yeah. Talk about the bidding process. I was surprised that what you called the hammer price is quite a bit different from what you actually end up paying. There's several tack-ons. Yes.
There is a big difference between the hammer price and the final price you pay. You have to pay a buyer's premium on top of the hammer price, and that could be anything from 17% to 25%. It could be higher than that, and the buyer's premium could work on a sliding scale as well. If in this country we have what's called VAT, value added tax, and it's sort of an additional tax on sales. If the, say this sampler came from a business, a dealer who's registered with VAT, the buyer will have to pay VAT on top of the hammer price and the buyer's premium. You will have to pay VAT on the buyer's premium anyway. If you're buying from abroad, you also have to factor in that you might end up paying a fee to the auctioneers to your bank to transfer funds.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Not all auctioneers I don't know of any auctioneer in the UK that takes PayPal. So, you know, you could be sending bank transfers where there's foreign currencies involved and, you know, transfer fees. And often if you pay by credit card, they'll charge you a surcharge on the credit card as well. So
it
does stack up. And you really need to check the auctioneer's terms and conditions because they're all different. And you just need to really sort of remember that the hammer price is not anywhere close to the final price. And of course, you know, if you're buying long distance, you have to get the item shipped to you as well. Some auctioneers will pack and ship, they'll charge you, but most of the time you have to engage a shipping company to go to the auction house, collect the item, pack it up and ship it to you. So, you know, if you are buying in the UK from the US, you know, you might be putting, say, £180 shipping charges on as well. So, you know, they're all things that you have to think about. And if you are thinking of buying from the UK and you're in the US, or even if you're in the same country, you can always ring a shipping company and get a quote before the auction so that you can factor it into the price you're paying for the sampler.
Yeah, that was when you were watching that one sampler that sold for $11,000. I don't know if you were actually bidding on it, and none of my business, but I was silently cheering for you to buy it because it was really beautiful. And then it kept going up and up, and I thought, okay, $11,000, that seems really steep for a sampler. But then when you told me about all these other fees, I mean, that's probably $15,000 effort by the time you get it in your house.
That's right. It's a beautiful sample, and I dearly wanted it, and I did bid on it, but, you know, I didn't go anywhere close to that because there'll always be another one. And that particular auction, that was with a very good auction house, a very reputable auction house, and the samplers that were being sold on Friday, they came from a collection. And, you know, those samplers were going for a lot of money. As soon as that auction started and the samplers were coming up, you could see that people were really going for them. And a lot of them were very expensive. The funny thing is that the auctioneers there described that sampler as American or English. But I know that that sampler was actually Welsh. And, you know, that was definitely a Welsh sampler. Yeah, the sampler featured a hot air balloon.
How odd.
It is odd why there's a hot air balloon. There's a group of these samplers that feature this motif, and they actually come from Pontypool in South Wales. And I was born in Newport, South Wales, which is the town next to Pontypool. And it's such a shame that when I was growing up, I probably went into antique shops many, many times and secondhand shops that maybe these samplers were there. But I just didn't have the interest or the knowledge. But I'm sure I will come across another one day.
Yeah. Yeah, because that was interesting when you pointed out the hot air balloon. I didn't realize, at first I didn't even see it, but then, so that was Welsh, so that, you knew that was much more than your...
And it's a funny thing, you know, I actually, when I first came across these samplers, there was an article on a blog about these samplers, and I did a little bit more research, and I was thinking, hot air balloon in Pontypool, that sounds really, really weird. But in Pontypool, they used to make what I believe you call in America tollware, where they have a tin tray, and it's painted with a sort of a mixture, I think, is asphalt and shellac, and it puts a lovely glossy surface on the tin. Anyway, this company in Pontypool, they used to produce, I think you pronounce it, chinoiserie.
And
I know that they produced a tollware tray that had that was painted with a hot air balloon to celebrate the Montgolfier brothers' first public demonstration of a hot air balloon flight in France in 1783. And obviously there would have been people in the factory producing tollware painting this scene. So that's probably where the image of that hot air balloon came from. And a lot of these samplers also have sort of like Japanese and Chinese scenes. They have pagodas. But this was what's on these samplers were being produced on this tollware as well. So, you know, that's how a hot air balloon came to be on these Pontypool samplers.
So you knew that there was more to it than what it appeared. Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. But the funny thing is they're called Pontypool samplers, but this school was S. Westbrook School, and Susan Westbrook actually lived in Abersuckham, which is just outside Pontypool. So they're not known as the Abersuckham samplers. So I just found that little bit of fact, and I knew Abersuckham very well.
That's great stuff. All right, now we have to stop.
Yes,
now see what's happened here is now you have to come back again because there are many more questions. So.
Okay.
You have to come back. So, all right. So you've been kind enough to give us three Old Scott samplers.
Yes.
And so we're going to, give away one each of the next 3 weeks through our midweek podcast. And
yes.
go ahead.
What I was going to say, Gary, is that the Old Scott has turned out to be the Flying Scotsman, which is a train, an old steam train in this country that used to go very fast. So in England, if you say the Flying Scotsman, you mean something that goes very quick. So many hundreds of people have already bought this chart. And what I wanted to say was, if the winner has already bought it, they can opt for another chart from our portfolio.
Oh, there we go.
Perfect.
All right.
Excellent. Okay, so what you have to do to get in on this thing is on the page for this podcast, this midweek podcast, you have to leave a comment and tell us about the first sampler that you stitched. So tell us about the first sampler, and then as people comments enter in, then that'll be your number, and then we'll do a random number, and then we'll announce the winner next Wednesday when we do our midweek podcast. And so you have... I didn't even think about what the time was. Let's say between now and midnight Eastern time next Tuesday. How's that? That's the time.
Good. Yeah,
all right.
That sounds good.
So that's it. And so that's a great little benefit. If you already have purchased the Old Scott, then you get to choose another chart from the catalog. Boy, that's very nice of you. Thank you. So.
Okay. Yep.
All right. So got to leave a comment and in the comment, tell us about the first sampler you ever stitched, and then understand that comments get moderated. So if you hit enter on a comment and it doesn't show up, that just means because I have to approve it, and I'll do them as quickly as I can, but I have this paying job that, you know. Yeah, so
we both do that.
Yeah, so we they'll get posted up. Yeah, they'll get posted up in the order that they show up. So that's the deal. So between now and midnight next Tuesday is the 23rd, midnight the 23rd, is leave your comments and have a chance to win the old Scott. And then next week in the midweek podcast, then we'll have a different question and we'll give away another one. And really appreciate this, Nicola, letting us do this. That's great.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Yep. All right, that's it. We got to stop. An hour 20.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Now you hold the record. You hold the record for the longest podcast, Nicola. So there you have it.
I can talk about selfless.
Okay. Uh-huh. All right. So that's it for this midweek podcast. Leave your comments to have a chance to win the thing. And Nicola, once again, thanks a lot. Really interesting stuff.
Okay. Thank you. Take care.